Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Hereska, and I'm joined today by ACS President Russ Feingold to discuss a few different topics that are related to the courts. First, we have to address the Supreme Court's new, but also maybe not so new, code of conduct and what it means for the pursuit of Supreme Court reform. And we're also going to discuss the latest on judicial confirmations, and we'll even look ahead to next year to discuss what voters can do to engage on courts come election time. I think that is plenty for one episode, so let's get started. Russ, welcome back to Broken Law.
Good to be on. Thank you, Jeannie.
It is always wonderful to have you, and I'm going to have you start by talking to us about the Supreme Court's, what it calls, a code of conduct. And as you know, ACS talks a lot about Supreme Court reform. We talk a lot about the court's need for a binding code of ethics. So did the court check that box?
They didn't check the box. And even so, it is not a question of checking a box. It's a question of doing something to restore the credibility and legitimacy of the Supreme Court, which is really in free fall. I'll tell you, when people hear that the United States Supreme Court doesn't have a binding code of ethics, they just look at you and go, well, why? I mean, of course, Congress should have one, the White House, everybody. But you'd think like the ultimate group that would have to have some kind of an ethical code would be the highest court in the land, which is, you know, unaccountable. They get to be the final word on so much. So the idea that this doesn't exist and the fact that it is in existence for the lower courts that they supervise. John McCain and I made sure there were gift ban for members of Congress. We made sure that the White House did the same thing. The idea that these folks can just basically do whatever they want is shocking by itself. And then their attitude, Jeannie, is, well, why should we have to do this? Not only did the tone of this code of conduct seem grudging, but I happened to see Chief Justice Roberts speak at the American Law Institute dinner this year. And he mentioned it and basically said, you know, we really don't need to do this. It's not that big of a deal, was sort of his tone. But, you know, we'll do something. And so they come up with this thing that's not enforceable, that doesn't have real rules about recusal. It's kind of a farce. And it means that somebody else has got to deal with this if they won't. And that somebody is Congress.
I want to dig into a point that you're making, which is the court acknowledges in this document that basically this is just a writing down of the same principles that the court has been following for some time. So basically the only thing that's new is we put it into writing.
Yeah, and of course the court hasn't been following it for some time, though it's, you know.
Or at least some of the justices haven't been.
Yeah, I mean some. But in very serious violations of any kind of principle, maybe not the literal rule. But, you know, the lack of adequate disclosure requirements is shocking. And then what they're willing to do in that context. And then the fact that there just is no binding quality to it. There's no
enforcement mechanism
or anything that could say, all right, here's a recusal situation. Justice Thomas's wife was involved with January 6th. Maybe somebody independent should look at this. But no, it just leaves it up to the justice. And that's not enforcement at all. And it undercuts, not only is it disturbing on the merits of the particular cases, but it literally undercuts the public's belief in the legitimacy of an institution that is given the power or has amassed the power to overturn the will of the people of this country as enacted through their elected representatives and the presidents of the United States. That's a huge deal. And the founders never intended the court to have this power. So they only get this power if they respect precedent and if they act ethically. And in both cases, they're not doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting in that, to me, the one benefit of this is that the court obviously felt it had to do something. This something was by no means enough. What they basically did was release an honor code. And given that there have been multiple justices that have blatantly violated ethics before now, there's no reason to think that an honor code, just because it's in writing, is going to have any effect. That said, again, the court did feel the need to release something.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the work that we're doing at the American Constitution Society and many other groups raising concerns, members of Congress raising concerns about this, the shocking stories that have come out through ProPublica and other publications have really put a spotlight on this. And yes, they are concerned. I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett has indicated some concern about this. Clarence Thomas, obviously grudgingly, but did recuse himself from a matter that directly involved his wife. So this creating this code of conduct is a reaction to that. And it's also somewhat, unfortunately, a way to sort of fend off Congress taking action, which could be bipartisan, claiming that Congress doesn't have the power to do this. That's wrong. Under Article 3 of the Constitution, I don't think there's any question that Congress has many powers with regard to the judiciary. It should never use them unless it's absolutely necessary. But when they ignore the need to have a binding ethics code, it becomes necessary. And so, yes, I do think the political pressure works here. Look, it's not supposed to be a political body, but it exists because of political context. They are appointed by people and confirmed by people who are elected. And those people were elected in certain political environments. So the truth is that they are going to be at least somewhat sensitive to this if they don't want to spend the rest of their lives on an institution that's basically declining in its credibility for the American people.
You draw a point about timing that I do think is relevant, right? We're right now, the same month that they released this quote unquote code of conduct is the same month that the Senate Judiciary Committee has been considering subpoenas for some of the right-wing donors of Justices Thomas and Alito. Do you think that the court's timing was in part an effort to thwart that investigation or to take the wind out of the Senate's sails?
I'm afraid it may be. And the tone that Senator McConnell used and Senator Lindsey Graham used, threatening basically, if you do this, we're going to bring hellfire down on you. This is corrupt. The Senate Judiciary Committee has a sacred obligation to look into inappropriate activities at the United States Supreme Court. Who else is supposed to do it? Maybe the House Committee could do it, but it's the Senate because it's the Senate that confirms justices. And so it's an abdication of the Judiciary Committee's responsibilities. If they don't try to get to the bottom of this, if they don't try to find out the influence that some of these billionaires have on the process, it's the only way to make sure that the public has some way in which to evaluate what's going on, other than directly attacking the court itself, which is not something you want to do. Have an investigation. So, yes, it is deeply troubling to me that they threatened everything to try to avoid this. And it makes you wonder just how bad it is.
Yeah, what they're trying to prevent from coming out. It is just maybe a little bit ironic that I think the court's code of conduct draws attention to the fact that if the court actually did have a binding code of ethics, if it had an enforcement mechanism or a body set up to investigate violations of ethics, it would have something to point to in trying to fend off the Senate Judiciary Committee's investigation. But when there is literally no alternative, there you have no defense against the Senate stepping up and doing its job.
Yeah, I mean, with regard to the lower federal courts, the federal judges, there's a mechanism in place. It seems to work. I was on Judiciary Committee for 16 years. We didn't have to meddle into those things. The only time that a couple of times that something had to be done was when somebody, a federal judge, had to be impeached for corrupt activities. I participated in one of those trials in December of 2010. But that's way down the line. 99.9% of the time, concerns are dealt with outside of the political process when it comes to the federal judges.
Yeah. So again, if the court wants to solve its problem, certainly its legitimacy crisis, it's not just that it needs a code of conduct in writing. It needs to have an enforcement mechanism.
That is exactly right. Nothing less will do.
Yeah. And I do want to just underscore the point that you made earlier, which is, okay, this is not the code that we want, but it's meaningful that the court felt the need to respond. And it is proof of concept, right? It shows that public pressure has an impact, that the justices are cognizant of public opinion and political pressure. And it should be motivation for members of ACS to keep up the pressure.
Yeah, it's an invitation for all of us to keep doing it. It's just simply a no-brainer when you tell people that should there be an enforceable ethics code for the Supreme Court. It's almost laughable. So this is an invitation to double up on the pressure. What we're asking for here is perfectly reasonable and necessary.
So I want to move on from that. We'll certainly come back to it. We'll continue to talk about Supreme Court reform since there is desperately still a need for ethics reform. We will be returning to that topic on future episodes. But for the moment, I want to cross the street from the Supreme Court to the U.S. Senate and talk about the latest when it comes to judicial confirmations. We are recording this on November 22nd. Note that the Senate left early for its Thanksgiving holiday, which I make a note of only because it means the Senate is leaving itself with even less time in 2023 to try and help President Biden catch up to his predecessor's pace in confirmations. So that's the staging. Russ, where are we? And what are you focused on right now when it comes to judicial confirmations?
Well, we're very concerned about the pace of the process of confirming judges. And, this is after we gave appropriate and fulsome praise to what the Biden administration did in the first 2 years. It was terrific. I mean, they ended up 12 judges ahead of Trump's first 2 years in terms of numbers. The diversity was off the charts. Instead of 80% white people and 75% men, it's almost the reverse. Almost 70% women, 67% of people of color. And there was professional diversity, public defenders, people that had represented unions, plaintiffs. So this was a really good start. This year has been a disappointment. Some of it is understandable. There was some slowdown in the Judiciary Committee because of the concerns with regard to Senator Feinstein. Obviously, there have been big issues going on around the world and around the country, but there's just no excuse for the sort of poor performance in terms of confirming judges. I won't say it's pathetic, but it's definitely disappointing. I mean, look, they only confirmed 4 judges in July. In August, they didn't do any. They instead of staying for the recess like the Republicans did, they took off. In September, which is a big legislative month, only 3. October, only 5. This is weak. And so what you need to do, what they need to do, and they fell behind Trump. Now they're 10 judges behind Trump's pace. And that's not the only test, as I said. It's not just numbers. It's who these people are, their background, and what they represent, whether they stand up for the rule of law. But you know, they're just not putting enough legislative time into this. I'm going to be clear, because it's really a 3-ring circus. One is, are the nominees coming out of the White House? 2 is, are they getting through Judiciary Committee? And 3 is, are they being confirmed on the floor of the Senate? You know, we've had concerns about all 3. All 3 of them have to work. But the fact is, the White House has done a pretty darn good job. They kicked out a lot of people over to the Senate, and there is a big backlog of some 30 judges who are ready to be voted on. And if they voted on everybody before the end of the year, they would surpass Trump's numbers going into the fourth year. That may not happen, but that doesn't mean they can't get this done. What they have to do is spend more time during the weeks they're here on Mondays and Fridays confirming people. They have to change the rules so you don't have 30 hours of post-cloture debate on Court of Appeals judges because the die is already cast. You know what's going to happen. And they have to, as you suggested, not take off recess every chance they get for as much time as they do. We have to expand the calendar. And, you know, when they're busy doing other things, as you and I have discussed, you know, when the House is in free fall and they can't even elect a speaker, well, it's a great time to get together in the Senate and confirm judges because the House has nothing to do with that under the Constitution. So this has been disappointing. I think that that can be turned around. Senator Schumer knows, both from direct conversations and from our public messaging, that we want to hold him to what he told us, which is he wants to get more judges confirmed than Trump. I think he might do it, but he won't do it unless we make it really clear that this is extremely important for the achievement of not only the Biden administration is an accomplishment, but also if we don't do this, we're going to end up with 2 systems of justice. You're going to have these seats not filled. They're going to be filled potentially by red judges from red states. And the result will be essentially 2 systems of justice instead of 1 system of justice in this country. That can't be tolerated under the rule of law.
Yeah. And when you talk about 2 systems of justice, the dichotomy where the majority of President Biden's judges have been to blue or purple states. And what we've seen in the past is that Republican administrations disproportionately fill vacancies in red states, right? And Democratic administrations disproportionately fill vacancies in blue and purple states. And so what you end up with is are judges of different ideologies in different states. And so you effectively end up with exactly what you're talking about, two systems of justice.
We had the good fortune, you and I did, to get one of the most brilliant professors I've ever met, Mark Lemley at Stanford, who's really a tech giant in the field of law. He did a statistical analysis based on what you just said, basically saying, look what's happening. If this continues, you're going to have literally two systems of justice. And that is up on the ACS website.
Yeah, we'll link to his article in our show notes. But I want to ask you to elaborate on this from the Senate perspective, because a president has the constitutional authority to nominate judges. That constitutional authority is not state specific. It's not party specific. And so in theory, the president can nominate folks for all pending vacancies. Why is it that you see an administration either prioritize or somehow only be able to target those vacancies in states that align with their party? What is the hindrance to filling vacancies in states of the other party?
Well, it's how much resistance you'll get, particularly in this case, from the minority party.
From home state senators.
From home state senators, and also just in general, but particularly from home state senators. When it comes to district court judgeships, the problem is the blue slips, which is that if a senator doesn't return a blue slip with regard to a nominee from his or her own state, it's been a tradition in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that's all it is, to defer to that and not move the person forward. But the Republicans completely disregarded this. When President Obama had the right to fill a whole number of Court of Appeals seats that are even more important than district seats, and the Republicans just threw away the blue slips there. They said, we don't do it. So we've been urging, begging, Chairman Durbin, to get rid of these blue slips for the district court judgeships. Otherwise, there are going to be all kinds of them that simply stay open or get filled in a situation that would be much more disturbing. And we've seen the enormous damage that just one district court judge did. It's like the Texas judge that screwed up the whole abortion pill issue by himself for a great deal of time. So that is one part of it. But also, there can be obstruction on the floor. For example, as I mentioned, when you have a Court of Appeals judge who's already got enough votes because they got through cloture, but they can use 30 hours, eat up legislative time. As I mentioned many times, in politics, people think money is the most important thing. It often is. But when it comes to the United States Senate, time is the most important thing. And 30 hours of legislative time is a ton. So to devote that to one Court of Appeals judge instead of doing the 2 hours that is for district court is inadequate. Also, when it comes to other kinds of nominations, you can do several at once unless somebody really objects and wants to do more.
But if you're confirming ambassadors, for instance, or executive
right, or
branch.
Military appointments and so on. Yeah. Senator Tuberville isn't blocking everything. But this could be applied to a number of these judgeships as well. So these are among the reasons. Plus, refusing to give a quorum, but not coming to committee meetings, other ways so that the process can't even proceed. So that's why they fear that. But this is historic. It would be a real shame, a real tragedy, almost inexcusable to not put the time and resources, because once they do have the votes. And if they make people stick around on weekends, believe me, senators don't like to lose their weekends. That works.
And the other concern that I want to acknowledge, because it's starting to creep in more, is the desire to fill vacancies in red states, but the feeling that the administration needs to compromise in whom they nominate. And so there's a concern that maybe we'll start to see less diverse nominees or more conservative nominees. And so even if the vacancies get filled, the profile of the judges going to red states will be different than the profile of judges going to blue and purple states, which again creates the system where the type of justice, the level of justice that you get depends on where you live. We're starting to see a slight drop in professional diversity. That's what ACS has been tracking in recent tranches. So how do you think of this, where we really want to put pressure on the administration and on the Senate to fill all vacancies, including vacancies in red states, but we also don't want them to do so by way of compromising on whom they nominate.
Yeah, I think it's a mistake to think you have to sort of dumb down who you put forward as nominees. But the way it usually works is there's usually some kind of a deal or a compromise where somebody might come in who a Republican senator wants. Of course, if it's somebody who's crazy or extreme ideologue, that shouldn't be allowed. But recently there was a pretty reasonable compromise put forward in Florida where, you know, one of the persons was somebody that Senator Rubio wanted, who does not appear to be an extremist. But then also a couple of very progressive other people were put on the federal bench. So the answer isn't, you know, just put in these really safe people, people that we're sure nobody's going to object to, but, you know, work on an agreement that will preserve the professional diversity that's been achieved or improve it, where, you know, once in a while in a red state, yes, you're going to have to accept somebody you wouldn't choose, but you shouldn't do that unless you get other people who you really do want. That's the way I look at it, and I think that's the way it often works out. It's not literally that they want to make sure that no pro-union people or pro-plaintiff people ever get on. They prefer not. But, you know, a great example is the appointment of Nicole Berner by the administration to the Fourth Circuit. She's one of the big labor leaders in the country. SEIU, one of their top people. She's been appointed to the Court of Appeals. They must believe that that can get through. So you don't have to, even though that, of course, is an area that's not necessarily as red, it's a sign that that can happen.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now back to the conversation. So looking ahead in terms of the amount of time that we have left, we're recording this in November. The general election is a year out. The Senate has 3 working weeks left in 2023. There are 34 pending nominations in the Senate. So in theory, as you've noted, if they confirmed all 34, it would push Biden one appointed judge beyond Trump's 187 in 3 years. So it is in the Senate's court to pick up the pace and once again, at least match Trump's pace. But also talk to me about 2024. Election years are a different beast. What should folks be looking at, expecting when it comes to judicial confirmations?
Well, you know, I think it's important that when you talk about 2024 and elections, you are actually talking about the context that judges come out of. We have to remember that. Judges come out of a political context. That's how they get chosen. And so what happens in an election year and what the message is from the people will affect who the people that are nominated and who get confirmed. So you can't look at them as completely separate things. And that means you have to send a message to your political people when you're deciding who to vote for, when you talk to a candidate for governor, for United States Senate, or whatever it might be. Somebody might be coming around your state to run for president if you're in Iowa or New Hampshire or somewhere like that. Let them know that this is important to you, that you believe courts matter.
You're talking about voters, when voters interact with candidates.
Voters interacting with people. Let's say somebody's running, right now we know that there are several people running for the United States Senate in California. All of them are getting the message from a lot of people, especially progressives. Courts matter. We don't like what the United States Supreme Court is doing. I want to know what your standards are. What's your emphasis? What's your priority on this? We also have to ask them what they're willing to do to make sure this process moves more quickly. You know, say to them, are you willing to give up your August recess if you get elected?
To confirm judges.
To confirm judges. And, you know, that has to also, I think people should ask, do you support judicial reform, which is the only thing that's going to help us change the Supreme Court in the next 25 years, is would you support adding seats to the Supreme Court? Would you support term limits? We endorse that as an organization. And I'm excited to say, as you know, that a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have heard this, but now all those Democratic candidates for the United States Senate in California are supporting these changes. That's a huge change.
That is unprecedented. It is
because constituents are talking to them about it in the election context. It's not something they just divined. You know, politicians react to what they hear from people, and they're hearing it.
Yeah. It's the phrase that as a voter, when folks say, I vote based on X, right? My vote is determined by your position on X topic.
Your ears prick up and when you hear that as a politician, you go, oh, wait, they're telling me.
Their vote is on the line.
Wake up. This is the one that you're being told the real deal.
Yeah. And I want to take that also to the state level, because it certainly applies to U.S. senators, right? What are you going to do to prioritize confirmations? That is absolutely a good question to ask U.S. senators. But at the state level, you also have gubernatorial candidates who are running for a position that in many states comes with the authority to appoint state court judges.
That's right. I mean, there are states with commissions, but many states have tons of vacancies during a governor's term, and they have to have a commission to do it. So in my state of Wisconsin, Governor Evers appointed a commission where I'm proud to say a good chunk of the people there who are on the commission are people that have worked with ACS. And look, they end up appointing an awful lot of people, especially the circuit court judges. And, you know, the way it works, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, it's extremely rare that somebody who is appointed to those positions gets defeated. They tend to be on there for a very long time. So this is extremely influential. And so asking a governor, you know, what kind of people would you want to see here? What kind of process, what kind of emphasis are you going to put on this? And it just happens that the Wisconsin Commission, Christine Bramer, a good friend of mine, used to chair, is a tremendous example of how this can work right. Minnesota as well, where one of our best people, Carl Procaccini, a strong ACS guy, always engaged in the governor's office, working on these issues. And he was appointed and is now a justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. So who gets elected governor and how they understand this issue is very important and should be something on people's mind when they're talking to people who are running for governor.
And just as you noted, that there's been a real sea change on Supreme Court reform and how prominent it is in the California Senate race. I just spoke to a grassroots organization in New Hampshire who generally are really focused on legislation in the state house. And they just held a program about how can we engage on the courts. And I think what you're seeing is voters are cognizant post-Dobbs of just the incredible impact that federal and state courts have. And so now the question is, how can I engage? Voters know how to engage on legislative stuff. They know how to take signs and go testify at the state house, but there is still this need, and I think interest in voters for direction on how to make their voices heard when it comes to judges.
Well, you know, in Wisconsin, judges are elected, so they have an opportunity there to directly talk to state court judge candidates. And I would say that the most recent example in Wisconsin is the most stunning example of this I have ever seen. I've been following Wisconsin politics for 60 years. And the fact that every single person I talk to around the country knows about the recent Wisconsin Supreme Court race, there's never been an election in Wisconsin that everybody knew about like this one. And it had to do with Dobbs. And Justice Protasiewicz was won by 200,000 votes because they felt that the system was out of control, that the Wisconsin Supreme Court was literally just doing whatever the right wanted. It was not really acting as a court. And people got engaged. The student and young people turnout was amazing because they realized what was at stake. So, you know, it's sad that the process has become that political, but it's become necessary to deal with it this way. And people have responded at a grassroots level in a way that I've never seen.
Yeah, I think the Wisconsin race was a really great story and an alarming one, which was it was the most expensive judicial race ever. And you just have this inkling of like, yeah, but it's not going to have been the most expensive race for long. It just feels like, just like with presidential elections, we're going to see more and more and more money spent.
Completely inappropriate. And that's why I spent a lot of my life on campaign finance reform. It applies to this situation as well.
But it's all the more important for voters to do their own homework, because you are just like you get plastered with TV ads for legislative races. You're going to see it for judicial races. And so start now, we're a year out, figure out if your state elects its judges, if it appoints its judges. If it appoints its judges, focus on gubernatorial elections and the confirmation bodies. If they elect their judges, start looking at your judicial candidates and make sure your friends and family are also paying attention to those races.
Well, you know what our mantra is, Jeannie, courts matter.
And who sits on them matters. So one last point, we are heading into an election year. We've just talked about how voters can engage on very, very important races. But is there anything else that you want voters or ACS members to really be thinking of as we head into what we are already describing as arguably the most consequential election season for our democracy?
Well, I hope people are alert, I think they are, to the fact that there are those who want to destroy this process and that will try to figure out any way they can to disrupt the local polling booth, to disrupt the Secretary of State's office, to disrupt the courts that would decide on any violations. And so people have to be alert and they have to be mutually supportive of each other, particularly those who are willing to get out there and be a poll worker. So, you know, one of our programs is to encourage people to become poll workers, and people can volunteer to do that. We had some 300 people, especially young law students, who volunteered to be poll workers for 2022. We want to greatly increase that number, and we actually have link to our page here, our poll worker pledge, so that people can have a chance to directly participate in this. Some people have been intimidated by some people on the right have tried to do to make them feel uncomfortable in this role. We need people in that role.
Yeah, and we've seen polling places, unfortunately, be shut down in previous elections because there weren't enough poll workers. You don't need to be a lawyer. You don't need to be a voting rights expert. Poll right. workers make elections happen. They're the ones that help answer voting questions, that help print out ballots, that make sure that every eligible voter is able to cast their ballot. We should point out, poll workers are needed in primary and general elections. And it is hard to fathom, but we are mere weeks away from the first presidential primaries happening. And so it is not too early to sign up to be a poll worker.
We're almost there.
Yeah, somebody who used to live in New Hampshire, it is coming quick.
Yeah, once you get past Thanksgiving, you're basically into the presidential election.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just as soon as the new year occurs, it's the Iowa primary and so on.
And to be a poll worker, usually you have to go through some sort of local training. And so it's great to sign up ahead of time, make sure that you're fully trained and ready to go for the primary. And as Russ noted, we will link to our poll worker pledge in our show notes. If you take our pledge, we'll make sure that you have access to the information on how to sign up to serve in your local community. And wherever you live, small town, big city, trust me, they need poll workers. So this is a wonderful way to give back to our democracy. Russ, thank you so much.
Happy Thanksgiving, Jeannie.
Well, this episode will come out after Thanksgiving. So happy holidays, generally.
We said that it would come out after. So that, you know, people already know, Jeannie.
Happy holidays. Drive safe. I hope everybody's travel plans go according to plan. All right, Russ, thank you so much. And to our listeners, if folks are enjoying the show, help us bring it to more listeners this holiday season by recommending it to a friend and leaving us a 5-star review. If you're driving to your families or flying across the country and have all those hours to kill in the car or on the plane, podcasts are a wonderful source of entertainment. So bring us along with you. Make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law on Twitter, or at American Constitution Society on Instagram and using hashtag Broken Law Podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.